Welcome to the Who Cares podcast, brought to you by the College of Behavioral and Social Sciences and the College of Education at Georgia Southern University.
Welcome back to Who Cares, casual conversations with Southern scholars. Today it is my pleasure and Ryan's pleasure to bring to you Dr. Taylor Norman. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Middle Grades and Secondary Education in the College of Education at Georgia Southern University. And she currently serves as a language arts content specialist. Welcome, Dr. Norman.
Thank you for having me, both Kanya and Ryan. I am excited to be here.
Great. Well, thank you for being here. And I'm going to start out with kind of a big question of English language arts. So first thing that my mind jumps to is literacy. So what do we mean when we talk about literacy?
Well, that's a very large question as far as I'm concerned. It is all I have done with my career since I was 21. I didn't know I was doing it for a very long time or that I taught literacy for a long time because I got into school because I liked literature. I liked to study stories. And so I imagined that teaching English would look like enjoying literature. So what I learned once I started teaching language arts is that literacy is everywhere. It's critical thinking, it's writing, it's reading, it's engaging with the world, it's being a global citizen, it's understanding data, it's understanding digital literacy. And then, of course, here I am using the word literacy to talk about literacy. And so it's a concept that wraps itself around itself. But as far as what I believe it is, it's about being an informed citizen. It's about recognizing when you have a piece of evidence in front of you is credible or it isn't credible. And so I learned very quickly as a high school teacher that my only job was to teach students to be literate in the fact that they could answer their own questions, that they were curious enough to ask questions, that they knew where to go once they had questions. But again, when I started teaching English, I thought it was gonna be teaching Shakespeare. I thought it was gonna be teaching poetry. And what it really turned into was a set of skills that we give our students that make them literate of the world around them. And we use classic literature to do that. We use modern literature to do that. We use writing to do that. But when it comes to how I define literacy, I would probably say it's my everything as far as what I trade in, like what my commodity is. it's what I think a lot of us as adults are talking about when we say that students, or we say that the children below us don't understand when the internet is tricking them or they're using social media in a certain way, that we really try to use language arts to harness those ideas in order to make them, again, productive citizens and also, you know, participatory ones too, I guess.
Okay. So I know, like you just mentioned, there are so many different definitions of literacy. How do you study whether people are literate? Are there different ways to do that?
Yes. Yes, there are so many different ways. And you know, I work in disciplinary literacy. I have since I was a graduate student at Purdue. And what I learned teaching disciplinary literacy is that everyone is again, trading in literacy. Okay, so if I'm a social studies teacher, there's a level of historical literacy that I'm trying to bring to students. If I'm in mathematics, it's the same level, right? There's a certain amount of literacy about my content that I'm trying to ask students to critically engage with. That means that as a teacher, there should be a learning objective with a measurable goal. So if I want students to be literate of the 50 states, then there should be a measurable objective with an assessment that asks, did these kids in fact learn that? So when I think about, again, literacy as a teacher educator could be different to a lot of different, you know, I guess literacy to people outside of my field could have lots of other definitions. But in my field, in education, the way that we work with literacy is asking ourselves continuously and reflectively how students are learning what we're teaching and how we're measuring that. Now, when you think about that as I'm no longer a K-12 student, now I'm out here in the world and I'm working in whatever career I've chosen, the purpose of literacy and language arts to me then is to prepare students to be able to engage with whatever they want to do once they leave the K-12 classroom. So then on the back end as a teacher educator, that's what I'm trying to endorse with the students that go out into the field to become language arts teachers. So as far as how do we learn if somebody's literate, yeah, I mean, it really comes down to a teacher understanding their trade and then also understanding how they measure what they do.
So tell me how this looks in your research, right? Like, what are you doing in the scope of your research?
So I could go to how I teach grammar because I use sentence diagramming to do that. And I know that it's an old technique and in a lot of ways has been called out as something very oppressive. And so I do not endorse that it gets done at the K-12 level, but I do believe as somebody who's teaching students to be ambassadors for the English language, that they should be very aware of the mechanics behind it. And so as a teacher educator, I teach students how to diagram a sentence in order for them to recognize where those dangling participles exist, how subjects speak to verbs, what direct objects do, what even a predicate nominative is, why we have so many different versions of verbs, in order for them to be literate of how language works so that when they're working with students in their classrooms, they can show them the dynamics or the mechanics behind why students are choosing to put their language in certain patterns, or that they make these constant errors because of this pattern they continue to do. And what if you as the teacher are able to see that that's happening and say to them, oh, well, I see what's happening here. You know, you've misplaced your verb or the subject doesn't agree. And that's something that should feel natural to them. So I use diagramming to give them kind of an answer key in their head when they see sentences they don't have an answer key for, which is how I was trained that when I teach grammar, I pull out the workbook, I look at the answer key, and I say, this is how this all goes together. Now, in our field in English education, the way to teach grammar is only contextually, which means that the teacher should be able to pull sentences from any text that they work with and talk to students about how those sentences are put together. If you're somebody who doesn't have that background knowledge in how sentences exist or are created or have patterns, you know, that you would be lost there. You wouldn't know how to pull a sentence out. So in my research, I look at what's happening to confidence levels with language arts teacher candidates when they learn this diagramming technique. Can they translate it into their pedagogical content knowledge? Can they all of a sudden say, oh, now I know what a direct object is and I understand how they're connected to the mechanics of a sentence? So in a roundabout way, that's how I use literacy in my research currently, just looking at how literate do students feel with those concepts, and then do they have the confidence to demonstrate their knowledge in front of a group of students? Because that's another big thing. When I first started teaching English, I remember just being around friends of mine of 10, 20, it wasn't that many years, 10 years probably. But they started getting really uncomfortable speaking in front of me because they thought all of a sudden I was gonna correct them all the time. And it's a switch, right? There's only some times when it's really important to me that I pay attention to what people are doing with language. And the rest of the time, it would be, you know, a point of frustration. And I remember my department chair was like, she would take pictures of billboards that had grammar mistakes, commercials that would create, you know, and I would ask her, how exhausting is that? You know, just recognizing where all the errors exist in the way that we use language. Because when we talk about the English language, I mean, we're talking about so many languages put into one language. And so rules that exist in French might be adhered to, but then also maybe a rule that exists in German that doesn't exist in French, but we're still adhering to that rule as well. And so there's just so many rules that come on. And when you decide to become a language arts teacher, you really have to be ready to, like I said, be one of those ambassadors for the language, where you can show students what they're doing with their language and then give them those tools to work with standard American English, which, again, is something that we have found is a systemic oppression, right? I mean, if you are not given the tools on how to create a complete sentence, then an employer could most definitely judge who you are based on how you've written something or created an email. And so the purpose of teaching teacher candidates to do this is, one, to gauge their confidence, but also to give them the tools to give their students the same confidence and then share that power of knowing the language with their students.
Okay, wow. Bringing up so many questions, and, you know, for me, I think I've mentioned to you, diagramming sentences was like the bane of my high school career outside of math, because I didn't understand why I was doing it. But hearing you say that, it makes so much more sense now to help understand just how to format that standard English. Which brings me to another question, though, of with the advent of texting, you know, a couple of decades ago, and computers, I mean, I notice even in my professional world, there's been sort of a, I don't want to say a dumbing down of language, but just a more casual nature to language. We don't have a formal, it's not as formal and florally, is that a word? Florid as it used to be, you know. And so does that impact of texting and online communication now, has that impacted how we consider formal language? And what is that doing for our teacher candidates coming in with that knowledge and having to go out with a knowledge of more formalized English?
Whew. Yeah, that's
how much time do we have, huh?
It really does feel like that kind of a statement. Well, I guess I'll begin. So when I first started teaching high school, texting had just become something that people were doing regularly. So it's the early aughts. And I when I first started teaching, I actually didn't have a phone that could text. I remember when I did get mine, but all of my students had them. And they had started, you know, just sending each other messages through that T9 capability, and they would be texting each other regularly. And so all of a sudden, acronyms started popping up on our short answer tests. We would get things like IDK under the short answer response. And we, as English teachers, are sitting in the office asking each other, what is this? You know, having to Google it, which was probably even Ask Jeeves at that point, right? But we did figure it out. We figured it out. Okay, so it means I don't know. Okay, so then we were all even more offended, because not only did you not answer the question, but then you didn't even spell the words out, so we could have gotten some punctuation in there and said something about, well, at least we know you know how to use contractions or something along that line. So that was the first time I engaged with, all of a sudden, the language is going to change, right? Then I remember standing over a student's desk, watching him work on an essay, and he had inserted the number 8 into the word later. So rather than L-A-T-E-R, it was L-8-R. Mm-hmm. So then I said, there's a number in that word. You know, this is a formal essay that we are writing for class, and there's a number in that word. And so he was taken aback, because to him, that's how he uses the word later. He's been using it on his phone more times than he's used it on a formal essay. And so that's what he wrote. So we stopped class and we had a conversation about why text language would not be appropriate in this genre of writing. And so that's kind of where my career started with, I'm okay with how you write on your text messages, but I'm also going to tell you that there are so many discourses that we all need to learn. And one in particular is how to write an essay with clear and coherent thoughts. Mm-hmm. And to do that with a word that has a number in it, you might lose some of your audience, you know? And so... so that there, and then I remember vividly a teacher that I worked with who had an adolescent son. They went somewhere on spring break. He sent 25,000 text messages over that week. Okay.
Wow.
And so I said, what was it? You know, and it, so it was a lot of those, it was emoticons before emoticons. So the parentheses and, you know, things like that, but they were sending just those simple messages back and forth, mm-hmm. which we now see happening all the time. I mean, gosh, if you sit through a YouTube webinar, you'll watch people just stream of consciousness through that, but we hadn't really seen that yet. And so now I'm thinking, okay, I have adolescent learners who are showing up to my classroom sending 25,000 text messages and probably never writing a 500-word essay at that point, mm-hmm. right? So right. How do I make that transition? Okay, so that all happens, and so I become fascinated with it. So I've watched it grow, and you're absolutely right, Kanya. It's not that it's that the language is dumbed down. We're just in a new era of language, and it's happened since, you know, the 1400s, when we had the great vowel shift happen. It happened, you know, right at the Battle of Hastings, when William the Conqueror came up to the UK, and all of a sudden we have another shift in language. And so we have all these eras in linguistic history. And again, I'm not a linguist, and I really need to say that, because as a teacher educator, I have a watered down version of linguistics. But either way, linguistically, the language has changed always. And so does it mean that it's dumbed down? I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's more creative. I think it has a lot more, or it's more dynamic. What's important, though, is because there's now all these newer genres of writing, is that we figure out how to talk to students about why the genres exist and what we do with them. And so that's where I'm at with that.
Well, I've also noticed this trend in using shorthand language in writing essays, even at the college level. And I grew up with a mother who was an English teacher, and so she drilled into me from a very early age that you need to write in a more formal way. And to this day, when I write text messages, I still write incomplete sentences with punctuation. And my teenage daughters both tell me that when you use punctuation in a text message, it reads as if you're angry.
Yes, I have heard that. Like, even a period, it's like, don't use punctuation. And I'm like, but then it's just like a stream of consciousness writing.
I will not do it. I do not endorse it. I do hear what the students are saying or the adolescents are saying. I think if they speak to each other that way, they see it that way. I cannot imagine. So my teacher candidates text me, and even, you know, I mean, of course, because everybody needs to be available, and they do tease me, and I have always been teased about using semicolons correctly and making sure that I have the correct end punctuation and all of those things. And so I'll get teased about it, but I've never had somebody tell me that they've misinterpreted what I've written, and I think it's because they know we're of a different generation. I think that if your daughter's talking to their friends, all of a sudden all this punctuation's coming out, we're having that issue. But just like you're saying, in my texting, I'm still practicing my grammar mechanics, right? It's just something that I'm doing all the time. If I'm a young adolescent and I'm not doing that, now we're losing that muscle memory that I might be using all the time. But again, like I said, who made all these rules up, and is it oppressive? Is it not? You know, and so it's also messy for me, because I, you know, came from a different region of the U.S. I grew up outside of Chicago in Northwest Indiana, and I come here, and grammar's used differently here as much as it was used differently up there, as much as it's used differently out east, as much as it's used differently in the U.K. and all around the world. And so, again, being that ambassador for the language can be one of those tricky spaces where you say, yeah, this is done incorrectly. The way you speak is correct. You're still golden. But the way that you wrote this, we still need to talk about why this is incorrect just here and in this space. But not all the time. And you're not incorrect. It's just the language that's happening here on the paper. But we do, anytime we write anything, I mean, all of us take it very personally. You know, it's our brain out on paper. And so the moment that you start to give feedback on things like that, it is so important that you recognize, one, the power you hold doing that, and two, even our own content knowledge. So I have worked with teachers that have corrected students in incorrect ways. And how do they then learn from that when the teacher's content knowledge isn't as strong as it should be, and yet we still sit in this really powerful place where we tell students, no, that's wrong. And they always seem to remember what we tell them is wrong well before we tell them what's right. And so, again, it's a tricky place to be, both giving that feedback and then endorsing the language and still trying to say that the student themselves is not the problem, right? But really, it's the system we live in. Mm-hmm. Really, it's the expectations of people above you in generation, because they expect something from you that maybe your generation didn't instill in you, you know? So again, tricky.
So it's almost something, correct me if I'm wrong, a little bit like you're saying, there's sort of a difference between language, spoken language and written language.
Yes.
And because I've noticed even a more informal spoken language as well, but I think that that is a literacy sort of, is that the first piece of literacy is the spoken language?
Yeah, if you go as far back in early childhood literacy, and even Noam Chomsky said that he is one of the famous linguists, that he's just not really sure where language comes from, right? Is it something that is naturally built into our brain, or is it something that's nurtured because we learn the sounds from the adults that raise us or who raise us? And so it's really complicated about speech versus written language, but we definitely know that written language is something that is added on top of needing to make an utterance about what's happening biologically inside of, or like in the space around us. So when I talk to students about thinking about the creation of language, is that we begin with, you know, why we need to talk to each other in the first place. Mm-hmm. And why even mammal or animals talk to each other is to warn them, to find food, to find shelter. And that's why we first started talking. And so when you look back at old language, it looks very similar to just a subject or a verb, because we're just looking for what is the thing and what's that thing doing. Then poetics hit the world, and we wanted to talk about how flowery language could be, and can I take this experience I'm feeling inside of me and bring it out? Now, can we speak about those things? Definitely. Can we share our feelings? Can we communicate about how we feel? Great. But when you tell me to look at it and think about what's on the page, like to reread my thoughts and continue to think about it, then the language started shifting dynamically, because we wanted to be able to say what we meant, which is where punctuation came into place, which is where, you know, subordinate clauses came into place, and all these other things, these complicated sentence structures. And I used to try to remind my students that what I was taught was that the comma was created mostly for drama productions or any kind of play, because the idea was to give the audience a second to hang on that word, because again, emotionally, that's how we react to things. And so what comes, it's like the cart before the, you know, or the chicken before the egg. I don't really know why we decided to start writing our thoughts down other than to just share with another person an experience we had. But speaking really became something about just communicating about the space around us and what was happening in order to, you know, again, communicate about that space with each other.
Well, that makes so much more sense, you know, because a lot of times in the way back days, you know, there were more people that couldn't read than there were that could. So.
Well, yeah, and again, that was something I studied right away when I first started studying medieval literature, was just who was literate and who wasn't. And again, to go back to your question about literacy, when I taught that disciplinary literacy course, it was a bunch of students who were not going to be language arts teachers. And so I would actually hide in the hallway while they all waited to come in that first day, just to see what they were saying about it, because they were really upset that they had to take a reading course and they were going to be PE teachers, or they were going to be science teachers, and they were teaching a reading course. And so when they came in, I would have to teach them that being literate or not literate is not the same as understanding what literacy is. Okay, I know you guys can read and I know you can write, but I want to talk to you about, what are you making your students literate of? And so the PE teachers were also always very fun to watch how they would come to life with this, because all of a sudden they would recognize that all the coaching they have ever done in their entire life had always been literacy. Mm-hmm. Biology teachers would realize those labs were key literate moments, you know. But, and again, it was about writing those objectives and understanding the assessment to recognize what makes literacy. But to not be literate, yeah, I mean, we've held all kinds of cultures at bay, you know, powerful people have in order to keep their power reigning, right? And so so we know that it is a way to keep cultures oppressed. And so, again, how do we make sure that students recognize how powerful it is, and then that they are also literate and understand literacy.
So, yeah, it's used by the powerful to oppress, but it can be used by the oppressed to become powerful.
Yes, it sure can. And Paulo Freire was one of the first pedagogues to say, you read the world with the word, or, you know, you read the world through the word, you know, and all of those comments about what it is to be socioculturally conscious comes into, well, if I can't read it, if I don't get to know that story you're sharing, then I don't get to understand that experience. And so my sister and I talk about this a lot, because we love to read fiction, and we usually read the same story at the same time. And she'll be so affected by stories and say to me, you know, I just can't believe that story. It just really got me. I always go back to, I know, if you weren't able to know that story, would you recognize that experience in your real life? Mm-hmm. You know, would you be able to come to terms with maybe the way it makes you feel, because, you know, you hadn't ever engaged with that story, or you didn't know about that culture, or you didn't know about, anyway. Yeah. And so young adult literature does that as well. In the adolescent language arts classroom, because it's relatable and it brings stories to students' fingertips, and then lets them think about, well, how am I wrapped up in this, and what do I know about this, and yeah, things like that.
That's really cool.
So at the end of the day, what would be a win for your research in terms of real world impact? What are you hoping to achieve through this work?
So most of my research is about, again, how to bring these practices alive and ensure that learning's happening. It's really, I mean, in my dream world, every teacher would want that to be the goal. And any administrator who is in charge of making any decisions for those of us who teach would first talk to a teacher about how they make those things happen. And then also endorse the ideas that are working for kids here in the United States. You know, the thing that you'll hear every teacher talk about are the tests and the standards and the mandates. And the standards have a reason, you know, they have a purpose, but the problem is that we've operationalized them in a certain way that has caused, again, oppression. And so it, the win for me is to see a bunch of teachers saying, this isn't working. My students aren't learning. I recognize that this objective does not have a measurable goal. I recognize that my students haven't met that goal. And please don't tell me to just move on to the next standard, because that's where I'm supposed to be in the pacing guide. But recognize that I'm an expert in my field. I do this type of work, and I read this research literature about how to do this kind of work. I can support my thoughts. I can support my thinking. And instead, you know, we've seen consistently in educational history that other people make decisions for those of us who work with the students in the classrooms. And that isn't lost on any teacher in the United States. It happens even to those of us. I mean, my brother-in-law is a private school university professor. And even there are top-down mandates that he follows, because that's how it works.
That's how it works. Mm-hmm. It's heartening to hear that there are teachers out there that are taking a broader view of their content rather than being solely focused on, like, ELA. This is what we're going to do in ELA, and never shall we lose outside the sight of ELA. And to really think about those other contents to become more interdisciplinary. I see a lot of teachers going, I don't care how they write it, I just want it written. Mm-hmm. I want them to turn something in. And that seems to be maybe leading to some of this, mm-hmm. Because we're on a time schedule and we have to get this done. You know, but that's what scares me a little bit, is that, you know, we're missing the boat, so to speak, on some things. because we've got all these wonderful, rich languages and cultures that we're bringing in, and we're not paying homage to that, so to speak, by just saying, just turn it in. I don't care what it looks like, just turn it in.
Yeah, and it's a point, there wouldn't be a teacher educator you could put on this show that wouldn't say to you that this is a point of contention we all share. We don't know what to do. And even in the early aughts when I was in my teacher education program, they were doing the same thing. We were learning of all this theory that made the world so broad for students, that just really said, take this one text and do social studies and do math, and you know, and it is so doable, you know. And then you get into the classroom and people tell you to forget that, this is how this is going to work and this is what we're going to do. And actually I wrote my entire dissertation on veteran teachers who didn't do that to me, and how empowering that was as a young teacher to recognize that my veteran teachers wanted to know what I'd been taught at the university level and wanted to operate, you know, under those tenets. And so, and again, and when I say all of that, I mean, you know, that we are making kids critically literate, that we are thinking about how race, class, gender, and ability all affect what's happening in our classrooms, and using the standards to teach something, but again, using the world, you know, to discuss how that teaching is happening, how it's all connected. But again, we're always going to come up against the pacing guide and the PLCs and the data craving. I guess that's the word I'm going to use, which is a terrible word because it's so negative, but they need the data. Everybody wants to hear about how you work with the data. And that's great as long as what we're measuring is what we're assessing. And that's where we can see a lot of disconnect if we sit down. And those of us who have studied statistics, you see it right away, that the plus or minuses are different, that you know, groups are being compared against each other that are not similar, that sample sizes are not uniform, you know, just things like that.
Yeah. Interesting. I think it's great, and I totally wish you the best of luck with your pre-service teachers, because they're going to be on the front lines for us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, empowering them is going to empower the next generation. So, Ryan, do you have anything else you'd like to ask?
No, it's very nice to meet you, and best of luck. I love this work.
Thank you, Ryan. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Dr. Norman, Taylor Norman, from the Department of Middle Grades and Secondary Education at Georgia Southern University.
Thanks, Katya.
This has been Who Cares? Casual conversations with Southern scholars, brought to you by the College of Behavioral and Social Sciences and the College of Education at Georgia Southern University. The opinions expressed here are those of the researchers and the host and not of Georgia Southern University or the University System of Georgia. We would like to give a shout out to Purple Planet for our bumper music. Join us next time for Who Cares? Casual conversations with Southern scholars.